Morning.
Morning. Morning.
Morning. You again. Can you see? Are you looking at the back of the TV?
I am.
Do you want to be somewhere else?
Yeah, I'll move to a chair.
Oh, that'd be great. Is there anyone else back there?
No, that's it.
Great.
Am I audible?
Yes.
Okay. First thing I want to acknowledge that we're on stolen Dakota land in a fractured, historically black neighborhood, and that we're practicing a tradition that was conceived of and developed and sustained by people in South and East Asia. And for those of us that are white body, to hold that, the implications of that constantly, actually. And that your presence here and that your presence in the tradition is one of service, rather than availing ourselves to something that we know we deserve. So I want to give a bit of a disclaimer. I've been working on a Jukai all week. And when you are, my teacher has this term. My teacher, before he was a Zen priest, he was an Episcopal priest for 20 years. And so he knows all these great church terms. And he calls us non-parochial, which means that you don't have a parish. Because until I became director here, it was kind of a floater. You know, I left San Francisco Zen Center, and then I had my own temple for a little while, but then I was kind of on my own. When you're on your own, doing little things, not little things, but doing something like an ordination is like 10 times harder. Because it's just like, I need this document that just shows up. Because at a place like San Francisco Zen Center, you have 50 people working for you for free. And you can just say, I need lineage papers. And they go, okay, we have a way that we figured out 50 years ago to do that. We have a relationship with what such and such printer. So, but for me, it was just like hunting down. And then there's this weird, actually, Sosan was really great. Sosan was very open and he was like, here's what we use and here's what we do. And then when I tried to email my home temple, it was a little bit like, well, we'll have to talk about it better. We can give you any of that stuff. So there's that interesting gatekeeping in different traditions. So I want to acknowledge clouds and being an open-hearted place. For me, this kind of like orphan showing up here, you know. And my home, not so much. But there was a lot of things to get in order for that. So I have a talk. I certainly have a talk. I certainly have thoughts. But I haven't quite made it linear. I haven't quite organized it. So it's like a... When you learn, you know how when you're in grade school, maybe you have this experience when they teach you to make outlines for an essay. There's kind of two styles to do it. There's the kind of Virgo style, where it's like there's the header and then there's the subheader and all that. And then there's the kind of like the bubbles with all the lines. This is a bit more bubbles with the lines. So if you need it synthesized, you might have to do it on your own. I was invited to give a talk before I even applied for or got the job as director. And I was given a list of dates, and I chose the one furthest away because I wanted to get to know the Sangha a bit. And I wanted any spikes in COVID to maybe have come and gone. You know? So I picked it for November, but there was an opening. Right now, so I did this right now, the day after the Jukai, we did it last night. And the request, I was given a topic. And I think the topic's based on a talk that I had given previously that there's clips of on my website, but about emotions in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. They're actually, when you go to the old tradition, emotions aren't really talked about. They talk about mental formations, and they talk about vedana, which is like feeling tone. And so sometimes that gets translated as feeling. And so when we hear that, we think, oh, this is about feelings. But it's not what we mean when we talk about feelings here and now, you know. So, like, strictly speaking, in the early, you know, in the tradition, when they say vedana or feeling tone, they just mean positive, negative, or neutral. That's the feeling tone. And then there's all of these mental factors, but it's not quite what we talk about when we talk about emotion and the meaning making that is present in our emotional lives. So if we're looking to the early tradition, or if we're looking for text for advice on emotions, we might not get something that's terribly useful. And if we think we're getting something useful, that might be problematic, because a lot of it is very dismissive. Dismissive in ways that I think aren't very supportive to us in our psychophysical situation. So there's a poem from Japan that I'm going to kind of paraphrase, but it comes from the Yogacara sect, which is also known as the Chittamatra sect, which means the mind-only school or the consciousness-only school. And it goes, at the clap of the hands, a server brings tea, the carp come for food, and the birds fly away. That's Sarvasala poem. And that's supposed to be demonstrative of one of the tenets of the Yogacara school, that an actual sensory experience can have a variety of meaning based on your karma. You know, so the meaning of a clap of the hands to a server at a tea shop or something like that. Or can you imagine? How rude, right? we were watching Columbo the other night, and the guy snapped, said, "You have the wine server come?" Mm. I was like, "Oh, that's terrible. Never do that." But the meaning of that versus to a human service industry human's mind versus a cart versus a bird are all different, you know. So which one's right? What's the correct meaning of a clap of the hands? You know. Well, if you're a service industry person, the correct meaning of a clap of the hands is perhaps a rude request for service. And if you're a carp, the correct meaning of the clap of the hands is that someone might be throwing breadcrumbs in the water or something like that. And if you're a bird, the correct meaning is like danger, get away. So all of them are the correct meaning. It's not like there's a correct meaning, you know? And that's what emptiness is. Emptiness means that there's this pivot. There's this pivot of non-inherent meaning of anything that arises. It doesn't mean that there's some kind of vacuous reality that's more true, you know? And I think that can be a problematic way of kind of like relating to emptiness without really kind of going into what it means. It doesn't mean an absence of meaning. It means an absence of inherent meaning from its own side, and the meaning is made in the moment when two things come together. And so one of the offerings of practice is to have some space around what the meaning makes. But it's not an invitation to relinquish meaning. And then, so if your karma dictates what things mean to you, what does it mean when you're practicing in a community, and practicing in a community where there are different hierarchies and different power dynamics, or if you're relating to a teacher that's had a different experience than you've had? And their meaning is different than your meaning, and different than your lived experience. And this has been one of the things that I couldn't wrap my head around for so many years in my training. Why I felt constantly invited into something that I couldn't quite do. You know, and thinking, gosh, I really must be a failure. But actually, I didn't really feel like a failure. I thought I was kind of gifted child. But I felt a discrepancy, you know, and I tried to fit myself into the situation that was offered to me, but I couldn't quite fit in, so I ended up non-parochial, where I have to kind of make my own lineage papers instead of having them made for me by an attendant or something like that. You know, I really blew it by not being able to fit in. So there's this danger, and I think, and I want to admit that a lot of my experience is from these kind of large residential temples. So some of those problems are problems that you have here. So I apologize if I'm trying to like say, this is what Zen training's like. And you're like, that's not really my experience in Zen training. Because it's a whole nother layer of complication when your teacher is also kind of your landlord and boss. Yeah. And then, and your boss, and you're working more or less for free. So there's so there can be cross-contamination in motivations, you know? So you get these kind of mixed messages where it's kind of like, well, we're here to discover our innate wisdom, you know? And drop your stories. And usually drop your stories comes when it interferes with you being able to be a good worker, mm-hmm. you know, or interferes with you being able to be a harmonious member mm-hmm. of the community. But I still think that that dynamic, I don't think it's exclusive to residential practice centers. I think anytime people get in a group, there's this kind of, you know, opportunity to feel pressure to get with the program, you know, and sign on for what the majority of the people in that group are doing. You know? And so teachers have a lot of, being a teacher, there's a lot of responsibility to recognize that your personal experience is not identical to the experience of the students. And I think with the history of American Buddhism being largely, it's tricky because the most important thing to talk about is the hardest thing to talk about. I guess the safest way to do it is to talk about my own experience. So, here's how I can say it. Because of your life circumstance, you might have hard-won boundaries that your teacher doesn't have, or that other people in the community don't have, or that the kind of zeitgeist of the environment doesn't have to deal with, you know? And it's tricky when emptiness is believed to be an actual vacuous thing rather than about an expression of the empty space that all relationships pivot on. The lack of inherent meaning that all relationships pivot on in each moment. So it's tricky whenever we're invited to let go or drop our stories, you know? Because that story could be what protects you. And I don't mean that in a negative way, you know? When you fit in, it's easy to say drop your story. It's easy to say let go. Because there's this kind of well, here's how else can I say. There's a presumption, because even when you let go, there's still something left, and there's something left that matches the zeitgeist of the group, or the basic. You know, like I was watching this movie. I like to watch bad biographical movies about ancestors, about Buddhists, because they're usually really, really aggrandized and absurd. And so we watched the other night one about the sixth ancestor, Huineng. And Huineng was a rice pounder. He was an illiterate barbarian from the south. And he came to the temple and they gave him a job. Since he was an illiterate barbarian of the south, they gave him a job that suited him, which was at the stables. You know, and stuff like this still happens in temples. Actually, you're given an assignment that seems, when you go to a residential temple, you're given an assignment that kind of matches the impression that you make on people. Oh, well, you know how to build. You'll be a mechanic. You know, and then so people kind of stay in the realm that they're used to. You know, office people do office things, and labor people do labor things and stuff like that. The rice pounding machine, I don't know, there's this, it's kind of an ancient machine, and it's kind of like a seesaw, and you jump up and down, or kick up and down on one board, and then this little, like, kind of pestle kind of thing goes into a little groove in the ground. And it breaks the holes off of rice, I think, something like that. And Huineng was too light for the machine, so he strapped a rock to his body, you know? And then when the fifth ancestor, his teacher, came to check up on him, he's like, it's so great that you're sacrificing your body for your work. You know? We lost our TV.
I'm happy. Yep, okay. They're still there.
Right. And then I thought, is that a position or is that not a position? You know? So whenever, you know, to acknowledge that there is a culture and there is a position, and when everyone's talking about a lack of position or a lack of identity, what's the baseline under there that no one's actually speaking of? It's a default presumed position. Yeah. So, how would I summarize that? I guess the takeaway that I would want to express is, to be careful when you're reading a book or interacting with Zen people or Buddhist people or yoga people. Yoga people are really bad at this too. There's this kind of wish-wash white. Not really yoga people. Well, no, really, everyone, sorry. but there's this kind of like, you know, not noticing the presumption baseline, you know. And so whenever you feel like you're invited to relinquish an emotion, is like, is that a position? You know, whenever you feel like you're invited to relinquish identity or give up your story, it's like, is that a position? And what's the real presumption under there? That there's this kind of, there's this pure thing. There's this pure thing called emptiness where we're all one. You know? Sort of, but the texture of that is in the particularities. There's no felt experience of emptiness outside of particularities, I think. You know, you're going to feel it. You're going to experience emptiness by way of your psychophysical existence, which is conditioned. There's going to be, you're not going to have an experience of emptiness that doesn't involve shit being in your large intestine, you know, or hair growing out of your skin. Gross. You know, there's no experience of existence that doesn't involve body aches or tear ducts, you know. So to realize that as well as that any ideal is a provisional cultural ideal, and it's not inherent in the tradition, like Wei Nong's teacher saying, "Oh, it's so great that you sacrifice your body." You know, actually, we need to make this our own thing that's relevant to us, and we need to figure out what's liberative for us instead of grafting ourselves onto someone else's ideal. I was thinking about, my student Haley and their spouse has been with us for the past couple days, and so we have like two little Dharma couples like hanging out at the house. And I was thinking about, we've been sitting at the house. We have tatami mats, and it's pretty well curated space, thanks to Minu's Dharma Eye. So we get up and we put robes on. We were having Oryoki meals at the house and stuff. But it's like two little couples. And I thought, gosh, you know, what would happen if Buddha came back? If Buddha came back and he saw me wearing a 7-panel robe, you know, holding hands with a partner, you know, would that be like, oh my God, what are you doing? You're not supposed to do that, you know? And then, if we explained to Buddha, we're like, well, there's been some changes in society. what being in a relationship has different social implications now. It doesn't mean that you're going to have children. It doesn't mean that you're going to have a household. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, have a dynasty of a business of some sort, you know? You can actually, you know, there aren't just men and women anymore, you know? You have that's a viable option now, you know? I feel like if you explain to Buddha, like, the changing dynamics of society, he might be like, oh, okay, that, you know what? It would have been nice to have a companion. I mean, we don't know what Buddha and Ananda's relationship was like, but they may have been very close. But to just presume, to take a snapshot of an ideal and just try to relive that over and over again. I talked to one of my Minna laughs every time I say my spiritual mentor, because it sounds like a cheesy name. And I talked to one of my spiritual mentors, and he was like, would you describe yourself as idealistic? I'm like, yeah. I'm trying to stop being this thing and start being these things, you know, when I imagine that, it's without the tear glands and the large intestines and the you know, ambivalence and the moods and stuff like that, you know? So I keep trying to reinvent myself in the name of these ideals. And if we're not paying attention, we can think that the tradition is actually suggesting that we do that, you know? I remember being at Tassajara, and Tassajara is so romantic, you know? Everybody puts on their little outfits, and you hear the... it's so long that there's han going at three different places because the valley's so long. So you hear three different hans going in the distance. You know, han's the big wooden board outside. And we get up in our little robes and we go to this like cold kerosene lantern lit cement wash basin and wash your face with cold water. And I remember there was a guy next to me with an inner plaque. Toothbrush. So it's all like incense and mist and kerosene lanterns and I'm like, you are ruining this for me. You know, I'm trying to live the holy life over here. So to acknowledge that the holy life has got to include our circumstance, and that we don't know each other's circumstance. And the thing that you might be encouraging, I remember one time, sorry, I think it's safe to just stick to personal stories. I remember I was at a retreat center that I used to live at called Vajrapani, Tibetan Retreat Center. And I saw an old friend from my punk rock days that got into Tibetan Buddhism. And and actually two old friends, and they ended up getting married and having a kid and stuff. And he had this job where he used to have to fly weekly from Santa Cruz, California to Carson City, Nevada. And I'm like, gosh, what a headache of a job. I don't get it. And then I remember they came to the retreat center, and I'm in my robes, and I'm like, what, 28 or something. And he said, no, they restructured the place and actually lost that job. Mm-hmm. And I think I actually said, oh, good. Can you imagine? I'm so humiliated. I'm so embarrassed now that I thought, oh, good. Because my experience was my experience of like, well, now you can attain the way, you know? And all jobs are bogus, and all careers are bogus, and having a mortgage is bogus, you know? And it made me such an inept priest, because I couldn't relate to anybody that had a different practice life than my own. You know, I couldn't even recognize it. You know, so for the first, it's a shame, actually. They let me give advice way earlier than they should have, probably. Because I'd sit down with people and I'm like, oh, why don't you just quit everything and go to monastery? It's obviously the only way forward in this business. Because I had a unique circumstance that came together because of my experience growing up of being super working class. My dad was a manager of a landfill. I grew up playing in dumpsters. I thought, I never met anybody that had a career that they wanted until I was like well into my 20s. So I'm like, oh, well, jobs are crap. Who wants that, you know? So I figure, all right, well, I'll move to a monastery so I don't have to deal with any of that stuff because it's all garbage. And then I started meeting people that worked in their field. And it was like a thing that they wanted to do and that they're doing it on purpose and that they like enjoy their lives. And I was like, oh, interesting. Where is it going with that? So I was kind of a bad example. I was bad at giving advice. And I think there's a degree that could happen every time you're in a scenario where people don't really get where you're coming from. You know? Mm-hmm. Do you raise your hand? Yeah.
Since I'm kind of off
script.
I was just wondering if you could go back to what do you mean by position?
Position. Yeah. Well, try to imagine what isn't a position but still has traction in the relative world. I can't really think of anything. You know, so I think when if you're face to face with somebody that's giving you spiritual guidance, be that an individual or a circle of people that are practicing alongside of you. And they might proffer, that's my new favorite word, proffer. It means like present, offer. Proffer the idea of letting go of whatever you're holding on to. I feel like there's an invisible, subtle, unspoken ideal that falls back on. That is not taken into account. Like when I think, I'm just really going to practice. Like, what does that mean? You know, what are the presumptions I belong there? And because I think there's something. That isn't fully thought through when some of that's spoken about, and I think there's this kind of it falls back on some kind of transcendental thing that is really unarticulated and vague, you know. So it's just kind of like saying, well, whatever you're doing now, just like don't do that. And there's this idea that there's a life that isn't that you can just do, mm-hmm. You know? I think it's a position that's rooted in something based on ideals rather than based on experience, I think. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but it seems like maybe you're talking, it feels to me like you're talking about something specific, but using very vague terms to talk about it. And so I'm having a hard time tracking. I want to understand.
Yeah. Okay. I'm holding that, and I'm just saying if this adds on.
Yeah. The way that I understand you.
Yeah.
In the crazy way my brain works, is that you're saying space becomes property, and this self that is holding the space is in denial about the fact that they are actually holding on to property. What used to be open is now claimed as such theirs, and they don't know it. And they're proffering that you let go of yours.
I'm gonna try to pick that up when I start trying to. But I think that's a help. At first, I'm like, I don't know. But then now I feel like that feels. I think there's something there that is close to what I need. Yeah, but I want to hear everyone, and then I'm gonna try to weave together some more specific meaning, because I think maybe everybody will help me make sense of what I'm saying. Yeah.
Okay. So, in this, we talk about the form. So where does the concept of form fit into what you're talking about?
Okay. Okay. I want to make little notes of everything I want to say, but I want to hear.
Yeah. If you want to weave in more about like emotions too.
Oh yeah, I didn't even talk about that, did I? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Great.
At the place that I've gone to for many years, it's never letting go. It's taking care of the rising.
Mm-hmm.
So when people are letting go, they want to pretend there's, what you said, nothing to take care of.
Yeah, yeah.
Just do something else and just forget about it.
Yeah, yeah.
There is something to be taken care of. It's empty, but there's something arising. You're agitated. It's disturbing.
Yeah.
Gotta be taken care of.
Yeah, one of my teachers says to experience things so they can actually move through.
Right.
You know, okay, so this is great. I'm gonna weave in everything everyone said. Okay. To the best of my ability. And then when do I stop?
You stop in 16 minutes.
Okay.
Great.
Okay, what this has to do with emotions, what this has to do with forms. And maybe hopefully the property of one's life, the bubble. Okay, so talking about Buddhist psychology a little bit, to talk about emotions. Is everybody familiar with the idea of paticca samuppada, or cause and effect, or the 12-fold chain of codependent origination? Yeah.
Pardon me, I can't do math very well. You have 12 minutes.
Okay, great. So what did Buddha wake up to? Actually, more than anything else, he woke up to this idea of cause and effect. Cause and effect in your psychophysical experience. You know, so you have a consciousness, and your consciousness has been perfumed by everything it's ever gone through. And everything it's ever gone through goes back to beginningless time. Because if you have cause and effect, you don't get to have a first moment. You know? So they say, so Dalai Lama says, yeah, Big Bang, but not the first Big Bang. Which actually, I think there's just a scientific article about the Big Bang wasn't the beginning. How could it be? Because there's got to be a cause.
Right.
You know? So your mind stream goes back into beginningless time, theoretically, right? And so it's perfumed by all of its experiences. So it has more quick reactions to certain stimuluses than others. This is basic conditioning. So when through your senses you encounter something, and, you know, and this is what they talk about in the Heart Sutra, eyes and sights, ears and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste. When you encounter something, there's communication happening with your karma. You know, your sense of self is taking that data from your sensory experience and is communicating with this emotional alert database based on all of your previous experiences, and then from within giving you the meaning, like the cart coming for food or the server coming, you know. And it could be a positive feeling, and then what arises in couple with a positive feeling is attachment. Attachment is the exaggerated belief that proximity to something is going to increase happiness. Or aversion, the exaggerated belief that separation from something will cause happiness or safety or whatever. Since all of that karma has been laid down, what is arising for you in the moment when you're encountering sense objects is already long in the works. So you can't actually, there's no point in giving yourself a hard time for the experience that you're having. It's not an experience that, an arising feeling is not something that you decided to have. It's a karmic result of everything that's ever happened before that. So part of our practice, this weird practice, which is not necessarily an early Buddhist practice, or not emphasized in the way that we emphasize it, of just holding space for what arises, and just being present for what arises, and without a preference for wholesome or positive mental states, or a preference for quiescence and stillness, just a preference for awareness. Experiencing what's arising, and letting that move through without taking that information and letting it inform the behavior of becoming. You know, the behavior of actually anchoring in more karma that reifies and reinforces that feeling tone or that belief system that's arising. Yeah. So there's something, like for me, can't decide what I want to do with this. It's safe. It's like a teddy bear. Like for me, being aware of my positionality entering into a situation can be often much more valuable and more important in me navigating that social experience with much more skill and effectiveness. You know? At the same time, sometimes I have wounding based on my previous experiences, which compound a negative outcome. So, for example, if I have a chip on my shoulder about no one ever taking me seriously, or because I'm always the youngest person at Zen places, I mean at Zen teacher places, usually. Very rare to be under 40 and have Dharma transmission, actually. So I got a little bit of a thing where, like, they think I don't deserve this. They think I don't know my stuff. I'm going to show them I know my stuff, you know? And when I have that a bit of an agenda, it comes off actually immature, which is the opposite of what I'm trying to demonstrate, you know? So there can be a identification can be supportive or negative, or impact your situation negatively. But so there's something to be said for having the space to choose whether you want to pick it up or put it down. You know? But that it's optional, not inherently bad and separates you from your awakening. You know, there's circumstances where it's actually crucial to be aware of your positionality. You know.
And by that you mean where you're coming from, whatever it is.
Where you're coming from, and to make as possible, as visible as possible, the presumptions that you have about what everyone's experience is. Because most people go through life thinking everybody's them.
Thinking everybody's them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The other.
You know.
Then you're going to say the same value system.
What's that? Yeah. Like you know, like when I'm a teacher, like, obviously it's great to sacrifice your body in the name of work. You know? And so what are all of the invisible beliefs that are we just take as a given, you know? I was listening to I'm obsessed with Hare Krishnas. And I don't mean like like Hindu Vaishnavas. I mean like the convert, like International Society of Krishna Consciousness, like organization that got popular, founded by Srila Prabhupada in the 60s and got popular in the 90s. And I listened to podcasts because it's so interesting. And I was just listening to one where there's two, they call them Prabhus, which is like elders, arguing about whether there should be female initiation groups, you know? And actually neither of them, there was one for it and there was one against it, but both of them took it as a given that men and women are not equal. Because it's in the orthodoxy of the organization. It's very interesting that, that, you know, I think about, and that's not something that they feel like they even have to explain. It's just a given, you know. I don't need to. But there, I think there's, weird beliefs that we have that are running how we feel about life, you know. And to make that visible and to realize that when we're leaking that presumption on to other people that might not have that experience, and maybe it's a gift that they don't have that experience, you know. Conning people into working 10 times harder than they are so that they can show that they're valuable to you. Maybe that's a burden that, you know, one person has that you don't need to share with other people. You know? Yeah, Nina.
I was just thinking about what Fukutoku asked about kind of what you mean by position.
Yeah.
And what Taizong was asking too about specifics, and then you use the word positionality, which I think of as how we occur to other people, kind of regardless of how we think we are or who we think we are. I think of my brain is turning what you're saying about position into kind of unexamined, potentially unexamined power or potentially unexamined belief systems or even privilege, right? And so, I remember being at Green Gulch one time, which is a Zen Buddhist center in California, and a white male teacher said something about how our job as students is never to say no. You can never say no. And I asked a question about it, but he, as an older white man, wasn't aware of what was happening in that space between us when talking to me as a younger person of color who's non-binary, and what our different experiences might have been around this idea of yes or no and boundaries. And so that space, that emptiness or that pivot between us where we could have met, we couldn't meet because, you know, maybe both of us in that moment were holding some things really strongly and wanted the other person to get it without having met.
Did you bring up that example the other day of like holding a moth? If you catch a moth, you can't actually hold it. You gotta have a space for it to move with it. And I think any belief has to be like that, you know, but you still hold it. Time.
Sorry. Just one more question, maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
I was thinking that a word that I feel is missing is, it seems like fluidity in positionality, that an awareness of the fluidity.
Yeah, and I do think in the caveat of fluidity is that it can't be summoned out of you by someone else. You know, like it's, there's no authority in any of this but yourself, you know, at the end of the day. And you can take advice. And I want to just real quickly, I got not a minute, but I want to talk about, so emotions, all of your emotions make sense. You know, Paul Ekman says that there's the big seven emotions that are presumably universal. Sad, disgust, grief, they all have a function in demonstrating to you in a psychophysical way of what's important to you. And they're evolutionary. You know, this feeling that we can kind of tell ourselves is kind of like a vulnerability or a weakness of like, oh my God, when I have this experience, my hands are tingling or something like that. That could be blood rushing to your fingers so you can fight. You know, and that is because our very being here is proof that we're descendants of people that evolved to have quick responses to threats, you know? And so part of the practice is holding enough space as that arises to be like, is this really relevant right now? You know? And then briefly around forms, I think forms are a way, I've really been into Confucius, and I think studying Confucius is a mistake. Not studying Confucius is a mistake that a lot of Zen students make, because it's really important to understand, if you're going to practice Zen in a formal way, to understand the motivation behind the concept of li, which is like ritual propriety, and that it's a way that people can like harmonize together. But li needs to be flexible when you're having something as culturally mixed as what's going to happen here. You know, you go to Aheiji Temple, you got all 18 to 24-year-old boys, all from the same country, almost all born in the temples. And so it's easy for them to say, this is our way. You know, of course you shave your head. Why would your hair mean anything to you? You know? And if you try to bring that into another context and paint that across everybody, you know? Or if someone says, well, I'm not the gender that you think I am. You know, and it's like, well, why don't you just, like, give that up? You know? And so there's a, so I think in forms, we have to be, you know, hold the idea of the concept of li, and that it's a way to harmonize and make something beautiful together, but actually take into account what everybody's bringing to the table at the same time and adjust it. And I think we do. You know, I didn't offer incense today. You know, okay, this time.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Thank you so much. I'm glad this conversation came for you. Feel free to talk to me anytime, forever, because I'm always just not on my day off.